You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 19th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week in a special edition of the programme, we're exploring the truth about inflation, the title of a new book written by UBS global economist Paul Donovan. We'll also hear from other experts and analysts as they reflect on some of the issues that Paul tackles in his book. We start the programme with Paul Donovan himself. He came to Midori House to explain why the simple yet far from simplistic topic of inflation is so important. And he began by telling us exactly why some investors misunderstand inflation.
Well, I think there's this belief which has been promoted over the years that inflation measures your cost of living. And it doesn't. It measures an aggregate cost of living in the economy, and that's very rarely what individuals think they're actually facing when it comes to inflation. One of the really big problems that we have is that when people think about prices, they only tend to remember prices of goods that they've bought recently. So high-frequency purchases, food, energy, that kind of thing. They forget about the flat-screen TV, which was cheaper when they bought it last year. And the other thing is that people's brains are sort of hardwired to remember price increases and to forget price falls. We are very sensitive to losing things, more sensitive to losing things than we are to gaining things. And so that skews people's perceptions of inflation. Now, that's fine in day-to-day conversation, but when you're making investment decisions, this can be a really big problem.
Looking at the history of inflation, what are the most important stages to have knowledge of? Are the cliched stories of wheelbarrowfuls of Marx, for example, useful?
The general history of inflation, I think, is very important. I mean, there's amongst investors today sort of this perception that inflation was a 1970s problem. Well, actually, inflation's always been around. I mean, we go back in the book to 1700 BC and ancient Babylonia, which had quite a number of periods of inflation. And throughout history, we're littered with inflation episodes. So what that means is, I think, we've got to be very careful about assuming inflation is dead in the current low inflation environment. It's absolutely not. It'll come back at some point. And for some people, inflation today is a very serious reality. I think that we can learn lessons from history about common causes of inflation, common episodes of inflation. Inflation is generally caused either because policymakers lose control of the money supply, or alternatively, because there's a surge in demand which the economy can't cope with. Those are the basic causes. And I think if people try and understand that, they can at least look for the early warning signs and prepare themselves in the future.
Paul Donovan describing some of the key themes in his book, The Truth About Inflation. And we'll consider another aspect, inflation hedges, next. When it comes to the view on inflation hedges, is this informed by proper measured thinking or more by historical accident? Paul Donovan takes up the story.
Gold is a good example that there is this reverence for gold, which is entirely an accident of history. The reason gold is so revered is that the United Kingdom went onto a gold standard in the early 19th century. And in the early 19th century, the United Kingdom provided most of the world's economists. And this has sort of become, you know, economic legend. For most economists, they look at gold and say, well, this is absolutely not a good inflation hedge at all. I mean, it's appalling. But of course, as soon as you say that, immediately gold bugs sort of creep out of their blogs and start attacking you for daring to challenge the shiny metal. But it is an appalling inflation hedge. The other difficulty that we've got, and this is, I think, where things really start to get serious nowadays, is what inflation are you hedging against? Because the inflation rate that you face as somebody who is elderly is very, very different from the inflation rate of somebody who's got a young family. And that's, in turn, very, very different from the inflation rate faced by a student. So what are you trying to protect against? That's one of the critical questions. Now, that means that if we look at a very standardized inflation hedge, like an inflation-linked security, that may protect you against general inflation. Probably doesn't protect you against the inflation that you really worry about.
So what are the best financial market hedges? It's a question often asked of Simon Smiles, UBS Chief Investment Officer for Ultra High Net Worth.
They can obviously buy TIPS, inflation-protected bonds, but protecting against the inflation one's facing, they don't necessarily match that because they're protecting against a specific inflation basket that often isn't so relevant, particularly for our richer clients. In fact, the best way, you know, we see generally to hedge against the impacts of inflation is simply by buying the equities of good quality companies with pricing power that are able to increase prices in line with inflation or indeed often above inflation. One area, though, which clients often see as a hedge for hedging, and in fact more broadly as a safe haven, is gold. And that's somewhere that I really don't share in any way the sentiment. It is an emotional asset, and if one is buying gold for an emotive reasons, there is validity there, but it's neither an inflation hedge nor is it a safe haven. In liquidity market-driven market panic sell-offs, throughout the last 5, 10, 15 years, gold also gets liquidated. And the risk to holding gold is even more pronounced today, given over 50 years of production of gold sits above the ground. This isn't a commodity which is going to be supported by the marginal production cost, or indeed by cuts in production, full stop. So not only is it being held in physical form, as it has been historically, you've also had huge increases in the holdings of gold ETFs. For example, the Gold Spider ETF has over $28 billion of market cap today. That makes the potential risk from market sell-offs and from a change in sentiment among the retail investor base even more pronounced today than it has been in the past. So when looking across financial markets, tips are only protecting against a certain type of inflation. Good quality companies with pricing power are probably the best inflation hedge we see, and gold is a very dangerous investment, in my view, if one's looking to hedge both inflation but also general market sell-offs.
Simon smiles there. In his book, Paul Donovan also explores the theme of inflation inequality. What is this and why does it matter?
Well, what we've seen over the last 20-odd years is a very unusual experience. Generally speaking, inflation for the goods and services that lower-income groups buy has been going up, and inflation for the goods and services that higher-income groups buy has, if not been going down, at least been very much more subdued. Put simply, it's cheaper to be rich than it is to be poor. And so what has happened is that we have not only seen a growth in income inequality in several countries around the world, we've also seen this growth in inflation inequality. And in part, this is due to the effects of globalization, which have tended to increase commodity prices over the course of the last 20 years and lower the cost of labor over the last 20 years. Now, if you're higher income, you will tend to spend more of your budget on labour, and if you're lower income, you'll spend more of your budget on food and energy and housing, which are commodity dominated. So that's why this has come about. And what it's doing is worsening income inequality, but in a very subtle way that's quite difficult to put your finger on.
Simon Smiles is also interested in inflation inequality.
I think it's an interesting point that Paul makes. I would differentiate, though, the very rich. In fact, for the extremely rich, inflation has actually been pretty high, because the prices of the things they tend to buy has gone up dramatically more than overall standard inflation measures would suggest. So you look at some of the large ticket items that that extremely rich clientele might be purchasing. London house prices up in excess of 40%, and even more so at the super luxury end. Luxury Louis Vuitton Keepall duffel bags, that's risen just over the last 5 years by 30%, and the list goes on.
When we come back, we'll hear from another of UBS's leading analysts and ask what inflation might mean for existing investments. We've explored inflation inequality and how individuals' purchasing power changes. What about the asset side? What can inflation mean for existing investments? Here's Kiran Ganesh, UBS cross-asset strategist.
We know that inflation can be very different depending on which income group you're in and what your spending patterns are. But when we're looking broadly at assets and how they're influenced by inflation, generally we see that fixed income assets will be affected most negatively by inflation. If you hold a fixed income bond with the low yields that are on offer nowadays of 1-2%, even a little bit of inflation can destroy your coupon for a given year. On the other hand, things like equities tend to offer slightly better inflation protection. If we see a slight rise of inflation into the sort of 4-5% range, then equities typically can perform relatively well. It's only when we start to see very high rates of inflation, maybe 15-20% like we saw in the 1970s, that things like equities suffer. But really in that environment, almost all assets would face difficulties.
Do some equity sectors perform differently in different inflation environments? Kiran Ganesh continues.
So if you look across different equity sectors, there's a huge amount of variation in how much companies are able to pass on price rises through to consumers. Typically, if you're selling a product which is relatively inelastic, that people really can't do without, then you are very well able to pass on price rises through to consumers. So a good example is things like energy companies. Most people in the short run can't do without petrol. So if prices of oil and gas rise, then you are very able to pass that through to consumers, who would say that they have relatively good inflation protection. You know, similarly, real estate companies and real estate itself, and people obviously can't do without a home. So if the price of real estate rises, if the price level in the economy rises, then you tend to be pretty well able to pass on those price rises through to consumers. You know, on the other hand, if you're selling goods which people have a bit more choice over, perhaps you're selling more discretionary product, then you're not quite as able to pass on price rises through to consumers. And typically, in a rising inflation environment, and perhaps your margins get squeezed and your equity price suffers.
Another interesting question to ask is why all the recent money printing has not led to greater rates of inflation across the board. Well, as Kieran explains, increasing the supply of money creates inflation, but it's really all about excess supply of money.
I think that, you know, Paul has actually made a very good comment on this previously, that increasing the supply of money, all else equal, does create inflation, but it's really excess supply of money which creates inflation. So if the supply of money rises at the same time as the demand for money rises, then you don't get any inflation. And that's exactly what we've seen, is that whilst, you know, central banks have printed a huge amount of money, the demand for cash among banks and investors has also risen. We can see that if you look at on the balance sheet of things like the Federal Reserve, a huge amount of excess cash is just getting deposited back at the Federal Reserve by the banks. So that money isn't really flowing through into the system. You know, at the same time, we've seen loan growth falling off as banks have been deleveraging. So whilst the central banks have been printing a huge amount of money, the banks have actually been withdrawing money from the rest of the system. So it means that overall, actually the growth in the amount of money out there isn't particularly high. So you don't have this phenomenon of too much money chasing too few goods.
That's the view of Kieran Ganesh. Up next, we'll hear about the challenges of telling the true story of inflation. In putting together the truth about inflation, to what degree was Paul Donovan concerned with the writerly challenge of balancing technical language and jargon with a story that has universal appeal? In fact, as he explains now, it's not that complicated, as we are all making economic decisions all of the time.
Well, for me, I think we all live in the economy. We all actually understand economics. Everybody makes economic decisions all of the time. When I go in and talk to school children, for example, I say, well, you are making economic decisions all the time. People just don't realise that they're doing this. So what we need to do is just frame economics in a way that people can understand very easily. There's no need to dress it up in mathematics and all the rest of it. And I think that's one of the great sins that the economics profession has been accused of quite rightly over the last few years. We've tried to pretend we're a science. We're not. We're the real world. People can understand economics. Economics is simple. Inflation is simple as a concept to understand. It's not simplistic. There's lots of different layers to it, but each of those layers should be readily understood. So I made a point in the entire book. I didn't actually want to include any equations. I had to break at one point and include one, the Fisher equation of exchange. But in my defense, it's not actually an equation. It's an accounting identity. That was necessary. But you don't need equations and mathematics and jargon to understand inflation or economics in the wider world. Anybody who is capable of understanding an intelligent newspaper or capable of understanding what goes out on Monocle Radio will easily understand what's in this book.
So what is this work? Is it a primer? Should or could it be used to provide a framework for how to do better business, better investments? Paul says it is indeed a primer to aid the understanding of inflation.
So I think there were two aims from the book. The first is to act as a primer. I think inflation is badly understood in financial markets. And this is walking people through why inflation is formulated in the way it is and how they need to think about inflation. But I think there is also a revelation element to this in terms of the issues around inflation inequality and some of the longer-term social problems that arise from this. And with an aging population, which many OECD countries have got, with a generally low inflation rate, where small differences in inflation can actually make a very big difference to rates of return. And in the aftermath of the financial crisis, when rates of return generally are lower, I think that the issues around inflation inequality and different social groups and different age groups having different inflation rates is something which is relatively new to many investors, but absolutely supremely important in the coming years.
Who or what then, in Paul's view, will write the next chapter in the story of inflation? He explains that greater sophistication in inflation accounting will be at the heart of the next phase of the story.
Well, I think when it comes to inflation, the only thing we can say with certainty is that there will be inflation in the future somewhere for someone. I would argue that greater sophistication in inflation accounting is probably the next phase. We've now, through technology, have a wealth of information about pricing in a way that we didn't 30 years ago, far less, you know, over 100 years ago when CPI indices were first being created. So I think it's possible to get a great deal more information about pricing and perhaps to start customizing inflation for individuals, or at least for broader groups. What's inflation like if you are a low-income pensioner? What's inflation like if you're high-income, mid-20s and single? This is actually something that we should start to consider. And I think that that will be the next big step forwards for economics and, frankly, for policymaking.
Here with a closing thought from Zurich is Simon Smiles, who has this programme's regular client view. Simon explains how ultra-high net worth clients holding as much as 20 to 40% of their assets in cash will find inflation increases destructive to purchasing power.
When I look through our ultra-high net worth clients' assets, and in fact our wealth management clients' assets more broadly, you're typically looking in the order of 20 to 40% of portfolios still being held in cash. Now, in a low, or in fact no yield environment that we currently exist in, any inflation, however modest, obviously represents destruction of purchasing power for those large cash balances.
And that's Simon Smiles bringing us to the end of this 28th edition of the Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance, every week here on Monocle 24. Paul Donovan's book, The Truth About Inflation, is published by Routledge. Listen to this show again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.